This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Baltimore, its problems, and the conditions that precipitate police brutality in the community. We are joined by Stephen Janis, reporter for The Real News and author of You Can't Stop Murder, Truths About Policing in Baltimore and Beyond, and Why Do We Kill? The Pathology of Murder in Baltimore. Some of Janis's recent stories include the true toll of policing in Baltimore, the arrest of a 7-year-old, and a walk through the neighborhood where Freddie Gray lived and died. Thank you for joining us, Stephen.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's start by a walk through the neighborhood where Freddie Gray lived and died, and what relevance that has to the loss of this young life, 24 years old, at the hands of the Baltimore police.
The Gilmore Homes area is, I think, a straight symbol of what has occurred in Baltimore over the past 20 years, which is, as the Inner Harbor and areas like Canton, close to the water, and predominantly white neighborhoods, have seen great economic growth, the west and east sides, which are comprised mostly predominantly of African Americans, and including Gilmore Homes, has continued to decline. If you walk around Gilmore Homes where Mr. Gray lived, you know, you'll see one of the things we focus on was a dilapidated basketball court, which had been in disrepair, not in use, according to residents, for about 17 years. So what was once a recreation facility now had become just completely decrepit and unable to use. And this is representative of what the city has done and the policies that have been in place for, I think, primarily since Martin O'Malley became mayor, which is that the city has spent predominant amount of its resources on policing as an idea for solution for these types of neighborhoods. So the idea was, you know, these neighborhoods are falling apart, and, you know, because of the lack of employment and all the other economic resources that put strain on the neighborhood, obviously you'd have issues with violence. And the way the city decided to solve them was, instead of, say, fixing a basketball court, just for an example, is to put police in there. So in those neighborhoods, you have despair, unemployment, you know, poor health outcomes, all the sort of attendant problems with poverty, and subsequently the Baltimore City government, in its wisdom, decided to apply, you know, very draconian policing policies. And so when you fast forward to the present day, what happened with Freddie Gray, you're seeing a culmination of years and years of a policy that people in the city say, you know, has pretty much left neighborhoods like West and East Baltimore out of the mix in terms of growth, and instead put this huge sort of policing effort and strategic effort into those neighborhoods, which is where you get to the point that Mr. Gray encounters these police. You have 6 officers on bicycles patrolling the neighborhood, sort of a little bit reminiscent of the zero tolerance policy in terms of just riding up on people and people who haven't really committed crime or done anything wrong and chasing him. And then the next thing you know, we have what happened and what occurred. And so even though it seems, you know, like we're at this point now, you're talking probably about policies that have been put in place and sort of underlying structural problems that have been fomenting for, you know, decades. So it's really just a culmination of all that sort of cross currents of poverty, neglect, and then, of course, the decision, and this is true in many American cities, the decision was made, well, we're not going to fix a basketball court, we're going to hire police. I mean, you could have fixed that basketball court with the salaries for that day for the 6 officers that were working there. I mean, it's really kind of absurd, but we've made the decision that policing is the solution. And so thus, we end up with a situation like Freddie Gray in a city that's, you know, pretty much turning in on itself right now.
I should say that in New York, there's a debate right now. We have 35,000 police officers, and one of the debates is about expanding the police department to hire another 1,000 policemen. And I keep thinking about the issue of no money for summer youth jobs and a dozen other things of a similar nature. You raised 3 issues, really, within your introduction. One is the kind of concept, really, the tale of two cities. When the mayor talks about the development of Baltimore, we're not looking at West Baltimore. We're not looking at West Baltimore.
No.
When they talk about destroying your neighborhood, what is there in that neighborhood? That's one thing that I want you to flesh out more.
Yeah, sure.
And then, of course, I want you to talk more about the zero tolerance, which is the equivalent, really, of our broken windows campaign here, which continues to criminalize people for de minimis offenses, and also the Jump Out Boys, which were part of...
Sure. Let me start with the development aspect, because I think this is important for people to recognize. Here's something, I just did a story on this a couple weeks ago. The city has pretty much incentivized development down in places like the Inner Harbor and already wealthy neighborhoods with very generous tax breaks. There's a variety of tax breaks called TIFs, tax increment finance pilots. What essentially they do is they pretty much exempt some of the biggest developments downtown from taxes for years and years and years. And the irony of this is that all this money and investment has to be subsidized in part by neighborhoods like West and East Baltimore because they don't have tax breaks. None of those tax breaks have been applied to either of those neighborhoods. So what happens is that the poorest people in the city end up subsidizing development in downtown. So if you drive around Baltimore today, you'll see construction cranes all over downtown and Inner Harbor, and you don't see that same sort of activity because, you know, there's been no incentivizing of it. And so, you know, I think I've talked to a couple council people just weeks before this happened saying, you know, this can't continue to happen. We can't ask the people who are the poorest to support the richest. But that's exactly what you have going on in Baltimore. And I think that's part of the problem. And then, of course, back to the idea of zero tolerance, I think part of the drive to sort of push for this gentrification, not necessarily gentrification, but redevelopment of downtown was the policy instituted by then Mayor Martin O'Malley, who now is touting himself as an extreme progressive, to implement what was New York-style sort of policing, but take it to a level, I think, that has unprecedented in American policing, which is where, you know, police were tasked with arresting people, not just, you know, stop and frisk, but literally arresting them for very minor things like sitting on the stoop or spitting on a sidewalk. I mean, these are arrests I covered, you know, and as you mentioned, a seven-year-old sitting on a dirt bike. And that led to roughly 100,000 arrests per year for about 7 years. And eventually there was a lawsuit by the NAACP and the ACLU, and the city admitted the policy was illegal. Within that, you know, it was learned that about 25-30% of those arrests were absolutely illegal. I think probably 50% of them were. And so the tremendous toll on that neighborhood, the psychological toll on that neighborhood, like Freddie Gray's, which were really the target of this type of policy where people literally couldn't move around. And you fast forward to today, when I went out to Gilmore Homes, it was quite simply the same thing. I mean, they still said the police officers won't allow them to walk around the neighborhood. You know, if they stand outside their stoop or outside their home, they'll tell them to go inside. So, you know, you have sort of this, we talk about a tale of two cities. It's pretty stark, and it was pretty much a political decision. You know, I think some of the leaders, like the mayor, is sort of expressing anger and bewilderment, but not recognition, and the recognition that this was almost inevitable. I mean, if you take a situation where not only do you sort of tax the resources of poor neighborhoods to bolster the development of already wealthy neighborhoods, which are predominantly white, and then you institute a policy of highly aggressive, and, you know, I think Martin O'Malley, who toured the city yesterday, really, you know, deserves a lot of the blame for these policies because this is sort of his strategy as mayor. And the community is still suffering from this. You know, when we talked about the Jump Out Boys, I talked about them last time, basically they would go into neighborhoods and they would ride into neighborhoods like Gilmore and West Baltimore and East Baltimore in vans, walk out, jump out of the vans and just put people in the back. You know, not for committing a crime, just because they need to get stats. It was a stat-driven policing. So these, all the sort of underlying imperatives behind what has happened have sort of been festering for a long time. And I think people who have been on the ground in Baltimore prior to this happening are upset but not surprised about, you know, what happened and why this happened.
One of the things that, just to catch us up now, the level of militarization of the policing apparatus, the National Guards, there are thousands of National Guard and cops in the streets. Tell us about what's actually happening and what Baltimore looks like now, and your thoughts on the matter. I'm frankly
appalled. You know, it's really weird because City Hall has become sort of like a palace with armed guards around it. You see, you know, military, National Guard sitting outside, police. It's like the whole city is under siege, and you know, it certainly, I don't think it helps, but one of the things that broke out, that came, one of the debates yesterday that became, I think, very central to this idea of criminalization and militarization was the debate over characterizing the protesters as thugs. Because the night, Monday night, when the protests first broke out, both the mayor and the city council president, Jack Young, went on television and called the protesters thugs. And that created an uproar. And I think why that's revealing is it's revealing because it's sort of a characterization of saying, you know, the people who protested pretty much, or even the people who protested, their concerns, there's no validity to their concerns because all they are is thugs. And, of course, thugs has no good connotations. So the next day, yesterday at City Hall, Jack Young called a press conference. He's a council president, Jack Young, excuse me, I should explain that. And capitulated and said, I'm sorry, I should never have called the kids thugs, and appeared with gang members who then talked about how they had helped protect the city and how they'd helped to protect store owners. And it was just a strange sort of, you know, for the first time you're seeing, okay, you want to call these people thugs or you want to, like, sort of dismiss their claims. Well, that's what you've been doing for 20 years. And I think for the first time, at least for Jack Young, he sort of came out and had some sort of recognition. Well, you know, once I make that characterization about the people and the city, you know, there's no going back from there. There's no healing. And there's no really to look at the concerns and say they're real. And I think that shows, like, sort of the great sort of, I don't know if it's self-loathing or if it's the fact that the city just can't acknowledge that these policies have really created a situation where people are criminalized based on where they live and the color of their skin, and that from there's really no hope or progress or productive outcomes, and that people will get angry about that. And it was a really sort of fascinating and very, like, revealing moment about the true character of the city. I think people are missing is that we really have been conducting a war on our own people in a way. You know, we've been conducting a war, and that war is, like, split right down the divide of who we are. I mean, you know, when you send police into neighborhoods that are already sick and ailing, and you say you unleash them and say just incarcerate anybody you can, you create a deep psychic wound. And you also have to adopt a language, like the language that Jack Young and the mayor used the night before, where you call people thugs because you have to dismiss them. Because the policies are so unjust, the only way to justify them is to find a way to dismiss people and to find a way to characterize them as not having any agency. And I think that's what you're seeing here, is you've seen a city where we have, you know, pretty much done away with the agency of people who are not in the winner's side of the equation of how we have developed the city. And that's why the mayor and the council president called them thugs, and I think that's why suddenly the council president might have said, you know, maybe this isn't right. And you look around your city and you see the National Guard, you see all these police, but that doesn't cover up the pain of the people who are suffering. So it's very complex and it's very deeply psychic here, but, you know, I think you're seeing a city trying to recognize that we have made major mistakes in the way we have executed policy and the way we've treated people. And that's going to be hard because the people who are in power right now, that's the policies they've sat by and adopted. And that's why I think they reach out and say thugs and things like that, because they have to sort of double down. They have to sort of say, well, we were right. And I think that's why you see the city so angry.
And what do you think the protesters should want? Now, you've done extensive research, much of it on the whole corruption of the policing apparatus, the racial animus that flows. And there is, of course, this specific case of the death of Freddie Gray, who I would certainly contend will wait for medical examiners and forensics, etc., but I would contend that his fatal injuries really occurred before he was put in the police van, which may have exacerbated it, but it was clear from the video that he was already mortally injured.
Yeah.
So what should people want in relationship to particularly the policing apparatus, with all the levels of corruption and stuff, some of which you have peeled away for us?
Number one, I think people I talk to sort of agree with you in the neighborhood and people who were there that, you know, the injuries occurred before he was put in the van, and that, you know, there should be a whole and transparent investigation. What has happened in the past where a prosecutor has waited 7, 5, or 6 months and then down the line said there will be no charges. I think that's number one. You know, anyone you talk to, whether it be at Mr. Gray's funeral or in the neighborhood, you know, expects a fast investigation, and they expect indictments. And that's number one. And I think number two, and this was actually a theme at the funeral, was that a lot of reforms of the police department, which were, you know, on the agenda in Annapolis, which is our state legislature, they want to see those reforms passed, many of them which would be an overhaul of our very, very favorable Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights that protects police officers in these types of investigations and in the disciplinary process, and some other reforms that would make it harder for police to commit a crime and still stay on the payroll. And for many people in the city, that's considered unfair or just bad practice, because a lot of police officers who end up being investigated not only stay on the payroll, but are later on, you know, remain on the force in cases that have been controversial. So I think they want to see reform. But I think what's going to be the biggest demand, and I've seen this percolating, I've had some people come into our studios who are talking about this, is some form of reparations recognition that these policies have severely damaged these neighborhoods, and some acknowledgement from city officials that resources will go back in these neighborhoods in the form of jobs, development, investment in schools, the things that have been lacking. I think there's a real sense that the mayor has to come to the table with something substantive that will be a transformative and acknowledge the true divide in the city and the inequality that has, you know, sort of festered over the past 20 years, and that there is some sort of true substantive, because a lot of times these cases happen and what city officials will do is just wait and wait for the, you know, the anger to die down and wait for the protesters to go away, and then, you know, things will go back to normal. But I think people this time are not going to accept that recipe, and I think they really want to see some recognition, acknowledgement that something has to be done in restorative justice terms for the communities that have suffered most from this policing practice. I mean, I can remember a couple years ago the mayor had cut the summer jobs program significantly. And in 2010, I just want to mention this because it's sort of a small detail, but in 2010 it was a very hot summer and I was working, and the mayor closed down the pools in August because she said they were $400,000 short of a pool budget, and it caused a bit of an uproar, and some corporate donors stepped in and reopened them. But, you know, that just shows you the priorities in the city. I mean, $400,000 is probably about 8 or 9 police officers for a week in Baltimore City, but they closed down the entire pool system in one of the hottest months of the year, and I think people need to understand when they're looking at Baltimore. And these little things have been happening over time. Recreation centers, we used to have 100 of them, and there's only 30 now. And although the mayor says the reason is she wants to build these more, the better recs, but, you know, if you look at the budget and the spending, it's gone down, but policing continues to go up. And so if you want to understand Baltimore, think about the fact that in August of 2010, when the city was really, it was a heat wave, the pools were closed down to save $400,000. Now, $400,000 in the parlance of a $2.6 billion budget is, as our budget director once said, decimal dust. So I think that's something that really personifies the problems and what the community wants addressed, that these type of things won't happen, that their recreation centers, their summer job programs, their schools will get the same sort of funding and attention that policing or downtown development gets. So I think that's what people want to see come out of this.
One of the things that I want you to just go back over, if you could talk a little bit about Visa and go back to some of these zero tolerance policies, because we do need to understand that more, and some of what you uncovered and looked at about the nature of corruption, if you will, in the Baltimore Police Department.
Well, you know, as I said before, what really zero tolerance boiled down to, besides the idea of you would, you know, based on the broken window theory, which is that a neighborhood is like a building in disrepair, you know, you arrest people for the petty crimes and the more major violent crimes will go away. But what it did was it changed the philosophy of policing from reactive to proactive and turned police officers into sort of an occupying force that would go in and target people based on their race or class or where they lived, and without any sort of recognition of the law. So what you had in Baltimore was a wholesale, if you can imagine, we have a city of 600,000 people, you arrest 100,000 people. I mean, mean, it's a stunning figure. I don't know how to compare it to anything because there really is anything to compare it to. I mean, a wholesale massive relocation of people into in and out of a prison on a daily basis based on not on the law, but the supposition that they were going to do something wrong, or the supposition that, you know, by putting them in jail somehow we would prevent violence. And that policy was not just about arresting people in crime, it was also about money, because when I was investigating it, I found not only did police have arrest quotas, but the arrests were often incentivized, that people could, if you made your five arrests by your shift, you got 8 hours of overtime, and, you know, you could go home. And so what that culminated is in 2006, I think, city police overtime had ballooned to like $40 million a year. The entire surplus that the city had experienced because of the real estate boom went into paying police overtime and basically for making arrests. So it incentivized this great sort of massive relocation of people, and it also meant a lot of money for police officers, 80% who don't live in the city. And so that money was going out of the city to places where people live. I mean, Baltimore police officers live in Pennsylvania. Some live in Delaware. I mean, they don't live in the city. So in a sense, it was like a great wealth extraction mechanism for suburban communities. And for people to come in, and, you know, you had police officers making $100,000 in overtime a year. So it was making people from the suburbs very wealthy at the expense of these communities and draining the communities of resources. And so, you know, zero tolerance was much, much more than a policing policy. And I think it was a social policy, and it was like a form of governance that, you know, a philosophy of governance that said, you know, that we're going to somehow suppress these neighborhoods, not in the sense that we're going to solve crime, but we're going to suppress their agency, and we are going to make sure that they aren't a part of the political process, and they can't make demands upon a mm-hmm. system that's treating them unfairly. Because, you know, once you have an arrest record, you're pretty much tarnished. And one of the things I would encounter over and over again when I'd write about brutality cases before this became a national issue here was that you would find, you know, you'd get someone who had been beaten up by police or some horrible thing had happened, and the minute you decided to go and write the story, the police department would send over an arrest record. And, you know, the arrest record, and they'd say, well, you know, how can you write about this guy? He's been arrested three times, even if he hadn't been charged, if the charges had been dropped. And so what it was a great great way to make sure that those neighborhoods where people were really, you know, getting the short shift of the city's economic boom, or, well, I don't know, boom, but, you know, development, had no say. I mean, because, you know, they're just, and that was what is at the essence of the idea of the thug idea. You know, they're thugs. They have no part in the political process. They are, you know, they're not worthy. It's hard to describe. It's like the entire city was sort of put under arrest. The way the political process is sort of make sure that things are fair and equitable was completely cut off, because what can you do? Oh, he's been arrested, or she's been arrested. You want to write about that person? I would get anonymous faxes in 2006 when people said faxes about people I'd write about with their criminal records from some number that was 0000, you know, and it was because mm-hmm. the whole idea was these people don't matter because they've been arrested. Well, you've also been arresting 100,000 people here, so almost everybody's been arrested. Well, everybody in poor and African-American neighborhoods. And so it was a great declawing of any political agency in those communities. So zero tolerance was really a political idea, and it was an idea in a form of governance that would make sure, I think, if you look at it, to make sure those neighborhoods couldn't say, well, why are you developing the Inner Harbor, and why are you giving tax breaks to big corporations on the Inner Harbor when our neighborhoods are falling apart? And just to give a really good example, the Harbor Point development, which is one of the biggest tax breaks in the city, went to build a corporate headquarters for energy giant Exelon, which is a Fortune 500 company, $100 million of tax incentives just from the city alone, while a place like Gilmore Homes can't even fix a basketball court.
We're going to have to leave it there, although we wanted to explore and we wanted to look at the foundations of policing, the nature of the neighborhood to
contextualize this latest police killing that has come to our attention in Baltimore. And Stephen Janis, reporter for The Real News, author of You Can't Stop Murder, Truths About Policing in Baltimore and Beyond, and Why Do We Kill? The Pathology of Murder in Baltimore. Thank you for your insights and for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks, Rami. I really appreciate being able to share, you know, what I've learned, and you know, I hope we can continue this dialogue because it's really important that people understand this in context.
Absolutely critical, and we're going to make sure that happens.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Eddie Conway from The Real News, and I just came down to Gilmore Homes to get an assessment of the residents' attitude about the state's attorney's indictments against the six officers that killed Freddie Gray. Interviewing people and getting an idea of how they felt about it.
Oh, great, great. It's a start. It's a start. And hopefully that it'll come through.
Okay.
Hey, I'm Kevin Moore. I filmed that video, and when I first filmed it, dog, I'm thinking, we about to get railroaded again. Mm-hmm. We just lost another brother, another mm-hmm. person that we love mm-hmm. dearly. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I just felt like it wasn't going to be no justice.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And then Marilyn Mosby coming, she locking it down, dude.
Okay.
They talk about we free. We ain't free.
Yeah.
Look around you, dog.
Yeah.
This is not freedom for us.
Yeah.
This is like another jail, man.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
We fighting for freedom.
Yeah,
and it's
that's
gonna
right.
all happen.
And like, I think everybody probably feel the same way. I feel like police been doing this for years. I know you probably know. I'm 20. I know you way older than me. You feel me?
Mm-hmm.
So, only thing I think my man ain't do is run fast enough to save his life. You feel
yeah.
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I'm just happy that them officers got charged. That was one of us. We'd have been booked. Kids get out of school.
Mm-hmm.
They want to play ball. That's why kids grow up doing what they do now, because that's nothing for them to do when they get out of school. Yeah, they go home, do their homework.
Mm-hmm.
They also like to come outside, play basketball, ride their bike. Ain't no playgrounds right here.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't nothing for the kids to do. Kids want to play ball,
mm-hmm.
play sports. Like I wanted to say is, like, growing up, your parents also told you to call 911 when you get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
When I was growing up, I had to call my family when I got in trouble. Now my brother gone. How can I call them? They might do something to me too. I swear to
God. He should have got medical attention. Why you gonna move him here, there, take him all around the damn world? And he was in pain from day one right there. He was hurt right then and there.
Yeah. Okay, after talking to the residents here, it seems like they are very excited, very happy that something happened at last after 111 deaths at the hands of the police. Finally, the residents feel like there might be justice, but they also feel like they should watch this and follow it so that it doesn't disappear in the near future or get reduced further and people get away with what everybody down here is still saying was murder.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.